From Vermont to Alabama, Texas to Minnesota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the economic lockdown to slow the spread of the Wuhan coronavirus is having severe economic consequences. Does the federal government have the tools to spur a recovery? We'll talk with Scott Sumner from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. President Trump has assembled a task force to set federal guidelines for getting America back to work. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth is here with the real story. The nation's spending spree over the past decade, along with coronavirus recovery stimulus spending, has caused the national debt to skyrocket. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Veronique Darugi of the Mercatus Center. And are state governments now overstepping their bounds with ongoing restrictions on both businesses and individuals? Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. There is no doubt the lockdown of businesses has knocked the nation's economy into a recession. To find out how severe the economic fallout will be, we turn to Scott Sumner. Scott is a research assistant at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Scott, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Scott, of course, America and the world have taken a huge economic hit as a result of this coronavirus pandemic. Can you outline for us the depth of the recession or even depression that we're likely to find ourselves in?
All the forecasts are that it'll be a quite deep slump in the economy with double-digit unemployment, probably the highest since the Great Depression. In terms of the duration of the recession, that's a lot less clear. Hopefully, it will be much shorter than the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009, which had a very slow recovery. But at least in terms of depth, this will probably be the deepest since the Great Depression.
We have seen the government undertake a number of different stimulus programs. Congress has passed three of them. Are those stimulus programs starting to have an effect? Will they have an effect? And do we need to do more?
Okay, so economists divide this up into like supply problems and demand problems. So stimulus can't really solve the supply problem right now. That means firms are having trouble simply producing goods because of the various shutdowns and so on. And giving people more money to spend doesn't really solve that problem if stores and restaurants aren't open and if people are afraid to fly or take cruises. So we have a supply side problem that's kind of unique. Normally during a recession, the problem is not enough demand. And if you pump money into the economy, you'll get more spending and you'll get a recovery. In this case, however, I don't think the stimulus will have a big effect right now. However, I do worry that this recession will turn into a demand side problem later on. That is, once we solve the medical aspect of the problem, perhaps with a vaccine, we still may be depressed. And at that point, stimulus can be helpful in terms of getting people spending again and getting businesses back up to a more normal level.
If Congress were to look at the fourth component of this whole stimulus effort, Scott, what should be included in that, if anything, or is this something maybe we should wait a bit for?
Yeah, I would prefer to wait a bit in general. So there's certainly some things that meet an immediate need, say beefing up the unemployment program, given the huge spike in unemployment, making it more widely available to independent contractors and so on. I don't think things like the $1,200 rebate by themselves do much for the economy right now. It's not really clear what the purpose of that is. In my view, actually, monetary policy is a more effective tool for stimulus than fiscal for a couple of reasons. With fiscal stimulus, that is what Congress is doing, you're basically either taking money through taxes or borrowing and moving it around to different parts of the economy. With monetary policy, you're creating new money, injecting new money into the economy. And in my view, that has a more powerful stimulative effect over time. In addition, monetary policy doesn't run up big budget deficits. So even though we are inevitably going to have to run larger deficits in the next few years, I don't think we should overdo it because that puts a future burden on taxpayers. So for those two reasons, I think monetary policy is more powerful and it's less of a long-term burden on taxpayers than deficit spending. So I'd like to keep the fiscal stimulus to somewhat lower level than some other economists favor and just target it towards those where the need is greatest.
The Federal Reserve has undertaken a number of steps in recent weeks. So that our audience can have a better understanding, can you talk a bit about what the Fed has done and why has it taken these measures?
The Fed has done quite a few things. They've cut interest rates almost to zero. They've done some other things like eliminating reserve requirements for banks. Probably the most noteworthy thing that's gotten a lot of attention is they've decided to intervene in more markets than is typically the case. So normally the Fed would create new money by buying treasury bonds, which is a very safe asset. And they'd buy these treasury bonds with the newly created money, which gets it into circulation. This time around, they're going to inject money through various programs, not just buying treasury bonds, but through various programs of buying corporate bonds and lending programs for businesses. So they plan to sort of distribute the money more widely through a number of different mechanisms. The downside of this is these are more risky. So the Federal Reserve is exposed to potential losses that are much less of a problem when they buy treasury bonds. Now, Congress has passed, as part of their stimulus, a pretty large fund, about $450 billion, to sort of backstop these losses for the Fed. So if the Fed does lose money on some of its emergency programs, there is a fund provided by Congress to cover those losses. But that would be probably the most controversial part of the monetary program this time around, is it's getting into areas of the economy that the Fed would traditionally stay out of, and they're absorbing more risk. But I do think it has had a positive effect on, say, the expectations in the markets. The markets have recovered somewhat, and I think it will benefit the economy a little bit down the road.
The Fed, having taken these actions, Scott, do they still have any tools left in the toolkit should additional action be necessary in order to keep the economy afloat and to start pointing us back toward a recovery?
Yeah, I think they actually do. I've always claimed that central banks like the Fed never run out of ammunition because there's really no limit to how much money you can print. If anything, the danger is, in the long run, if you print too much, you can end up with hyperinflation like in Venezuela or Zimbabwe. We're obviously not in that situation. Right now, they're providing money where there's a demand for money, and it's not creating a lot of inflation. But there's no limit to how much the Fed could potentially inject into the economy. The other thing I would point to is that the Fed could adjust its targets in a sort of subtle way that a lot of economists think would be very useful. And this concept is called level targeting. It means that if you miss your target, say for 2% inflation, you promise to come back to the trend line a year or two out in the future. And this actually tends to help create what's called a V-shaped recovery, a quicker recovery. Now, the problem we had in the last recession in 2008 is we sort of settled on a lower track once we went into a deep downturn and never got back to the previous trend line for inflation or GDP or anything like that. So if the Fed promises to try to come back to the previous trend line and buys enough assets to create stimulus or demand in the economy, that can help boost expectations, make businesses more bullish, and can speed up the recovery. But with an important caveat, this can only be effective once these lockdowns end. There's nothing in my mind the Fed can do right now to significantly help the economy as long as there's a lot of mandatory lockdowns.
We have been talking with Scott Sumner, who is a research associate at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Scott, tell us a bit about the Mercatus Center. Also, where can folks go to read your writings?
Well, I have a blog called The Money Illusion, and I also blog at EconLog. And the Mercatus Center is a research institute that's sort of loosely associated with George Mason University.
Scott Sumner of the Mercatus Center. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Scott Parkinson, once again from his home office as the Club for Growth keeps moving along, and so does our weekly talk with Scott. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Lots to talk about this week. Let's start out. The president, of course, this past week announcing a commission that will begin making recommendations as to how to get the country moving again. This Economic Advisory Committee just getting things underway. Your initial thoughts?
President Trump announced this week that he was going to appoint about 100 folks to a Great American Economic Revival Commission. And this group has experts from agriculture and banking, construction and labor, our national defense, energy. It's got food and beverage folks. It's got folks from professional sports, healthcare. It's got hospitality, all the hotel leaders. You've got real estate leaders. You've got rental leaders. Of course, you've got tech and telecom and transportation. And then you also have folks that come from various advocacy groups and are considered thought leaders. So this is a commission that I think President Trump is hoping to tap into to figure out the best ways to reopen key sectors of the U.S. economy.
Is this likely to be a situation, Scott, where, as some folks have said, we don't just throw a light switch and everything goes back to normal? We're likely to see a partial rollout of a return of individual sectors of the economy, perhaps even individual states or even counties within states?
Yeah, I mean, I think the zip code approach makes sense. There's some counties in rural parts of our country that might have 1 to 4 total cases of coronavirus, and the rural hospitals are not overwhelmed. But then you obviously have outbreak areas. Obviously, New York City has been the key example that folks have pointed to, where we've seen just the caseload explode and them even retroactively adding thousands of deaths to their role. So I could see the president certainly doing that. I think you could also see phases of key industry in terms of how they reopen, right? We might not be seeing the sports bar reopen, but perhaps there will be a restaurant that can accommodate patrons and actually get some of their workforce back. And then when you look at professional sports, I think you and I agree that we're not going to be filling the National Basketball Association's arenas, but perhaps they can start playing and getting our professional athletes back to work and at least entertaining the country at a tough time.
In the midst of all this, we have had these so far 3 phases of what's being called an economic stimulus. So we can have a long discussion about that. But all of this spending that has occurred, $2 trillion on the latest round, Scott, and the country already has been deficit spending, more deficit spending likely ahead. Is anybody starting to become concerned about the level of debt?
Very few people are. This is something that I've started to take a close look at. What exactly is the debt and deficit situation going to look like once we make it through an economic recovery? Obviously, we're just at the very beginning of what the economic impact of coronavirus is going to be for the long term. So I would expect even more spending to happen. But when you look into exactly what we've already done, I think it's clear that we are currently headed for at least a $5 trillion deficit right before the 2020 election. We were already headed for a $1 trillion deficit when the economy was humming along. And in the interim period, phase two included $134 billion for 2020 in relation to costs in the coronavirus response of Families First, is what they called it. That's the one that included that big burden of the paid leave mandate on small business owners. And then phase two included about $2.2 trillion in costs. You obviously have expanded unemployment insurance. You've got the Trump rebate checks that folks should have been receiving this week. And then you have the liquidity that we provided for corporations and small business owners. So the Paycheck Protection Program that had $350 billion available to small business entities. And actually, that ran out of money this week, if you can believe it. So Congress has sort of entered this stalemate of what to do next with the next phase. And in the interim period, both chambers announced this week that they would not return the week of April 20th, but instead were pushing back to at least May the 4th. The joke in Washington as we enter potential return of Congress is, may the 4th be with us all.
Well, according to President Trump, the Constitution actually gives him the power to adjourn Congress. And he's threatening to do this, Scott, obviously, because there are a number of appointments that have not been confirmed. He wants to do so-called recess appointments. Does the president actually have the power to push Congress out of session?
Yeah, I mean, this is a little-known section of the U.S. Constitution. It's Article 2, Section 3, and it actually says that the president may both convene the houses or either of them in the case of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. So this has never been invoked before, but what you've seen in terms of obstruction of the executive branch nominations, especially during President Trump's time, we do have historic levels of confirmations for circuit court nominations and district court, but there's a ton of executive branch nominations that have been stalled because the Democrats have totally held up President Trump's key officials from receiving confirmation. We're talking about the Department of National Intelligence. We're talking about key undersecretaries at the U.S. Treasury Department and so on. So it's not just about filling the judicial bench at this point. These are executive branch nominations that are critical to the economic recovery and honestly, the U.S. safety and health during coronavirus. So I think what you're seeing right now is President Trump sort of trying to put this clause out there to Congress saying, it's time for you guys to come back so that I can fill these key nominations. And if you're unwilling to do that, I'm going to take an unprecedented step and actually invoke this key clause of the U.S. Constitution.
Scott, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Club for Growth is a membership organization. And if anybody, any listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll talk with you next week.
Thank you.
A lack of fiscal restraint over the past decade has caught up with us as the national debt balloons to historic levels. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from Veronique Darugi of the Mercatus Center.
Back in the old days, by which I mean all of, 3 months ago, budget hawks were rightly worried about the return of trillion-dollar deficits this year. This was going to be the first year since Obama's first term where the federal government was going to spend more than $1 trillion more than it collected in taxes, and that was bad enough. Now it's worse. It's a lot worse. Experts say that we're headed towards a $4 trillion deficit this year, and that's probably a best-case scenario. That's, of course, a result of the massive surge in spending and an expected collapse of tax revenue due to the coronavirus outbreak. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Veronique Darugi. She is a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center. And her latest piece at National Review takes a look at the coronavirus and how it is inflating the deficit and the national debt to really just unbelievable levels. Veronique, as always, thank you for taking some time and joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The piece that you just wrote this week for National Review, folks can find it at National Review online. That piece says that the prudence during good times means the ability to spend during bad times. I think that pretty well sums it up. I don't want to lean too heavily on the "we told you so" element here, but those of us who do care about the country's fiscal situation have been warning about this for a while. The deficit's been getting bigger and bigger, and that limits our ability to respond to a crisis like this.
I think it's totally fine to say "I told you so." I mean, we say it each time, and by the way, we're not the only one. The Congressional Budget Office, in many of its report, highlights the fact that not getting our debt under control makes it really hard to face national emergencies, whether they're national disasters or terrorist attack or, as we have now, a pandemic. And it's really quite amazing because in good times, people usually start saving. They spend, less, they borrow less because they don't have to. And the government just seems completely oblivious to any of these. And in fact, the last 4 years, almost 4 years, have been insane in the amount of spending that Democrats and Republicans have been willing to spend and how much they've been willing to put on the national credit card.
Yeah, we, of course, spend massive amounts of money when times are bad. There was a ton of government spending during the last recession, and we are going to see, I think, just unbelievable levels of government spending in the next few months. Whether that's necessary or not, you can argue about it. I think some of it probably is. There's certainly some that may not be. But regardless, there was this strain of fiscal conservatism that emerged, really became briefly sort of a dominant element of the political right after the recession, after that, the stimulus and all of that under Obama. That has basically gone away. Republicans don't seem to care about the deficit anymore at all. Is there a chance after this we maybe see a return of that fiscal conservative strain?
There is, but as Bob Higgs has said in other contexts, there's a ratchet effect, which is, sure, when the government expands, it tends to, during an emergency, it tends to scale back its power after it's done, but never back to the level where it was before, nor to the rate of growth that we had before. And this applies to spending. What was really actually quite stunning the last 4 years is, by all accounts, the economy was doing great and wages were growing and yet the debt was going up. And I mean, and I think this is kind of what has changed in the last 20 years, is that there used to be a significant increase in debt and deficit during that time, but at least in good time, there was some scaling back, never to the level where it should have been, but because the economy was doing better.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, if you think back to the last time there was a period of nearly a decade of solid economic growth, I'm talking about the 1990s, you know, the federal government came out of that period of time with actually a small budget surplus. And now we've exited the good times of the 20-teens with a near record deficit. We are talking to Veronique DeRougy, senior fellow at the Mercatus Center, talking about the coronavirus and its impact on the debt and deficit. I know we are in one crisis right now, and I don't want to be too much doom and gloom here, but $4 trillion deficit, rapidly growing national debt, this makes me wonder that this is going to slow long-term economic growth even after the public health crisis passes, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's worth noting that academics have actually done the last few years, it's been really disheartening to see the number of academics who spend a lot of time trying to debunk this idea that actually debt matters. And so Jack Zaman and I at Mercatus, we actually wanted to see whether that was actually the representative views of the studies that were published on this issue. And we did a review of the literature. And what it appears is that actually the voices that are strong in talking about the debt does matter. I mean, they're not representative of the vast majority of the literature. I mean, with the exception of two studies, all the studies we reviewed had, and that were on this topic, found what Reinhart and Rogoff found, which is that basically an increase in the amount of debt at some point start having an impact on the economy. And that is, I mean, it's important because it's a well-established fact that spending can crowd out economic growth, but this is an added effect because it's actually not just spending, but it's also the debt itself.
Yeah, and just making payments on the debt, obviously that becomes more difficult too as the debt gets bigger. This is all somewhat theoretical for now, but I think we are headed towards a very practical lesson in the economics of having too much debt on the other side of this coronavirus crisis. We are unfortunately out of time for today. Veronique DeRougy from the Mercatus Center, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that is Veronique DeRougy. You can check out her work for Mercatus at mercatus.org. She publishes lots of interesting stuff up there. Check out our coverage of the coronavirus and the national debt and everything else that's going on at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. I'll be right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The line between rights and responsibilities has become blurred, and that is when government oversteps its bounds. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
In my lifetime, I've been witness to some fairly catastrophic events. While in Eastern Europe, I witnessed the after effects of the fall of the Soviet Union, I served in Iraq and briefly in Afghanistan. In our own nation, I've seen the dot-com bubble bursting in 2001, the collapse of the housing market in 2008, and now the pandemic of 2020. There have been panics throughout the history of the world. In the United States, there have been panics of 1819, 1837, 1857, 1873, 1893, 1929, as well as the most recent financial calamities. The panic of 2020 is different, however, and we must understand those differences and realize that panic is not the answer nor the solution to COVID-19 at all. Today, more than ever, we must have faith. To have faith is to trust is to believe, and to believe is to have faith. It is a triangle of solid leadership. We must have faith in God and in one another and our responsibility to one another. In the panic of 2020, the economy had been so strong in its underlying fundamentals that the triggering event, a pandemic, should be easy to overcome because of that underlying strength. The economic difficulty, though, is that we, and we alone, hold the key to whether the cure is worse than the disease. It is clear that the pandemic is real. It is serious. People's lives must be saved. It is not, however, an issue over which the financial ruin of the world should be a potential consequence unless we will it. It is difficult to attempt to put the coronavirus in perspective while people are dying, but the panic of 2020 and the cure that some governors are putting in place may actually trigger an economic disaster and concurrent loss of life far more devastating than the disease itself. To be clear, if we, as citizens, overreact to the panic of 2020, we jeopardize placing the entire world in a deflationary spiral that most of us will be dealing with for the rest of our lives. In the Marine Corps, we rate our non-commissioned officers and officers on a trait, a leadership trait, called presence of mind, or effectiveness under stress, which reinforces the ability of a person to operate effectively, mission-focused, and with the ability to lead under periods of extreme stress. Great leaders can frequently have their message distracted and damaged by other leaders and citizens who lack that singularity and clarity of focus under stressful circumstances. In the case of the coronavirus, it would be clear immediately that saving everyone is an impossibility. And then, as painful as that is to deal with, it must be dealt with for the greater good and survival of all. It is painful. It is real. It is what presence of mind is all about. Perfect solutions in the case of COVID-19 are not possible. The great leader deals with the difficulties at hand, provides guidance and leadership, and strives to stabilize the current situation while preparing to rebuild. It is an irresponsible person that would not lay down partisanship and politicization for the greater good of society and the people who will become the pawns and victims of their sensationalizing of an already difficult situation. The responsibility to deal with the reality of the crisis is a civic responsibility. This does not mean that we are not to question, but it does mean we have the responsibility not to sensationalize. Screaming fire in a movie theater is not a right of freedom of speech by any stretch of the imagination. The Bill of Rights gives every American rights, freedoms, and liberty. The Bill of Rights and Constitution enumerate where my rights start and your rights stop, and vice versa. It serves as a basis for public discourse. Rights without responsibilities end in tyranny. Our nation is at a crossroads. Whenever the lines between rights and responsibilities become blurred, government almost always oversteps its bounds, as we are seeing in so many states limiting movement, non-essential definitions, and other liberty-restricting rights under the guise of a declaration of an emergency during the panic of 2020 because some leaders at the state level lack presence of mind. A government that feels you are not capable of making sound, rational choices and decisions is supplanting your wisdom and self-determination with those of the collective good in their minds. The concept of taking personal responsibility will have been lost. If we are to avoid an economic disaster in this current crisis, we must all have the presence of mind to deal with the medical crisis, help reduce the spread of the disease, and take personal responsibility in those actions. Only through our emphasis on our own presence of mind and accepting personal accountability will our nation be rebuilt. Our founding fathers left us a wonderful legacy. What we do with that legacy is our decision and ours alone. Pay now or pay later. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KEDU-FM in Ruidoso, New Mexico. Welcome to our new listeners in the Land of Enchantment. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.